Hey, welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, October 28th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Okay. So now that we've gotten the highs over with, we can say goodbye to El Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, that austere
exactly.
Religious scholar who repeatedly raped people in his austerity and murdered thousands and immiserated millions and was all in all one of the worst people of our time. We can get to the whole question of why the Washington Post web team saw fit to change the headline of its obit from master terrorist to austere religious scholar and what that says about what is going on in the media today. But before we do that, maybe we should dilate upon the more important issue, which is the actual targeted killing of El Baghdadi. So, by the way, interesting thing that this now suggests is that we have now made a total shift in American policy after the failed assassination attempts on Fidel Castro in the early 1960s led to a blanket policy that we were not to use assassination as a tool of American foreign policy. It is now evidently... That is now, Obama started this and Trump has now sort of hardened it, that we in fact do use targeted assassinations as part and parcel of the way we conduct ourselves in the war on terror. I don't really have anything more serious to say about this, except that like when I was growing up as a teenager paying attention to foreign policy, it was axiomatic that American behavior in this regard was among the worst things that America had ever done. I think we're talking about the series of assassinations, Mossadegh in Iran, Arbenz in Guatemala, and then Diem in Vietnam, all of which were.
But I bet we still wouldn't assassinate leader of a state that we recognize as a state.
I think there's also a big distinction to be made between covert actions and the support for proxies and really overt. Blind screaming efforts to decapitate regimes, like the early strike in 2003 on the Hussein regime, and these raids on non-state actors.
Fair enough. Although the Diem thing was a covert action. I mean, it's not like these were you know, we used our military to go and, you know, hunt people down. It was still black.
Most
black
of it was
ops.
Kind of a giant screw up.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it were giant screw ups. And anyway, but this just occurred to me as we were talking. So this was an improv. And basically, I think we've run to the end of this. We can't yes and it anymore. So we can move on to
I mean, the big headline here is that the president deserves a lot of credit for making a really tough call on a mission that was canceled twice previously. This is deep and hostile territory, and it's never easy to make that call, and there's a lot of reporting around how this was made more difficult by the president's decisions leading up to it, which I can't argue with, and I don't think anybody would. Nevertheless, there is a clear impulse on the part of reporters and the audience that consumes this kind of reporting to limit the extent to which the president deserves credit for a victory here.
I mean, this is part of the nature of the toxic partisanship of the moment, because I think pretty much, not quite as extreme, but I mean, some of the same was true when Osama bin Laden was killed, and Republicans and conservatives were very grouchy about having to give Obama credit. They sort of understood that he had to be given credit, but we had already sort of gone down the road of the nothing that Obama could ever do could be good. So therefore, when he did something that was, to everybody's mind, a sort of an unalloyed good and something that was necessary and also sort of a statement of American purpose in some sense, it was hard for people to say. And the interesting thing is that with the sped up nature of American life, The objections to Trump's deserving any credit to this happened, you know, roughly 45 seconds after the event itself, as opposed to sort of the requisite couple of days of respectful silence or something.
The other thing that I remember at the time that was hard for some to acknowledge about when we finally killed bin Laden was that a lot of people had decided that bin Laden was already dead. And that was a sort of, that was a way of not facing the fact that we let him go, that we had missed him for years and years.
Right. The bodies.
Right.
The next stage is the conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Right. Well, Christine, sorry.
I was just going to say, but Trump risks doing the same thing that was deeply annoying that Obama did after bin Laden was killed, which is the triumphalist, now we've defeated them because we've killed the leader, now it's over. And in fact, didn't Trump just say earlier in October, we defeated ISIS even before Baghdadi was killed? So
Trump is one of the people who said, don't give Obama any credit for the bin Laden killing. It was our special forces that deserve all the credit.
Well, he isn't capable of grace, but his opponents can't adopt that trait too. But it is, that point, I'm writing about that point too, and it's really important. His impulse to say, you know, sometimes he just appeals to superlatives to describe his own exploits. So maybe it's just that. But the impulse to say this is bigger than Osama bin Laden is really troubling because it's indicative of a pursuit of a political narrative, which is what got Barack Obama in so much trouble.
Right. Well, you know,
they were the JV team, right? Right. Yeah. ISIS was the JV team, according to Obama.
The Orlando massacre efforts were made as late as 2016. Efforts were made on the part of the administration to suggest that this wasn't a terrorist activity, that this was, you know, just hate exercising hate for hate's sake.
Remember. The line in 2012 was General Motors is alive and bin Laden is dead, right? Which then led, I'm going to offer a kind of slightly cracked narrative of the last 7 years, but the cracked narrative will go like this. So our ambassador and contractors are killed in Benghazi. The Obama administration is incredibly loath to say that this was a terrorist act of state murder
6 weeks before an election,
because they had contrived this narrative about how bin Laden was no longer a threat to the United States, therefore a terrorist act like this couldn't have happened, therefore it was because of the video or whatever. Which then led to the massive confusion around Benghazi and what we did in the 24 hours before and after the killings in Benghazi, which then led to the Hillary hearings, which were part and parcel of the way in which Hillary Clinton's pretty overwhelmingly favorable reputation in the United States among the American voter when she stepped down as Secretary of State, when she had a 65% approval rating, were knocked down into the 40s by the time she actually started to run for office. Had Barack Obama said this was an act of terrorism, we're going to get the people responsible, they're the same people who, you know, went after us on 9/11 and we are still engaged in this battle, Mitt Romney would have had to support him, would have had to say nice things about it. No one in the country would have objected. It would have strengthened his reelection campaign, and the Benghazi hearings would never have happened, and Hillary Clinton's electoral possibilities would have risen, and a lot of other things
would have never found out about the server. The server came out.
We would never have found out about
the Benghazi hearings. So
exactly.
Susan Rice did Sunday show as a butterfly flapped its wings, and Trump became president 6 years later.
Right. So I think what is really, really important here is to understand that how you respond, whether you respond properly to these large scale events that are, you know, potential sort of hinge moments in history. I mean, not like all of recorded history, but at least our contemporary, you know, moments in time, that if you overreact or you sort of lay too much emphasis on the meaning of any individual moment, that you are prone possibly to blunder into mistakes that will have weird, totally unanticipated long-range consequences. That if Barack Obama had responded properly to the Benghazi killings, Hillary Clinton would be president today is not something that is easily dismissible. And the fact that he didn't and she isn't are potentially very closely related. So that's not to say I know how Trump should respond or what will happen with Trump's response, but it's a cautionary tale at the very least. What do we make of the fact that there's another possibility, by the way, which is that the pullout from Syria and the incredibly negative reaction to it among Democrats and Republicans was the spur that led Trump to make the risky decision to make the move.
Well, this certainly helped, I think, falsely, but this will largely publicly help his case for getting out. You know, it makes him look serious about killing enemies despite our not wanting to police the world, in his words.
I mean, that seems to me like the conspiracy theory. That would be the conspiracy theory that his opponents would embrace, that this was a political activity and not an operational necessity.
No, I don't think that's a conspiracy. I think I'm saying that he might have foreborne, but he was Maybe. Reeling, but he's been reeling from the response. He thought the response to the pullback in Syria was going to be way more positive than it turned out to be, and he therefore could have, doubled down on the logic, which is that we're not doing this anymore. Or he could have thought, well, you know, I got to show people that I do mean business. And
it's possible. I'm not dismissing it, but the reporting suggests that this has been in the works since the summer.
Right. So. But also that they had
to speed up the timeline as a result of the president's activities.
Yeah, but you yourself said that they had plans for it and called them off twice.
Yeah, because it has been in the works from the Republic reporting that we know.
Yeah,
Can I just say something about the tone of the way that the president spoke about this military victory? Did anyone else find it kind of bizarre that he spoke about it like he'd been watching the latest Netflix movie? And the fact, you know, he went to the Nats game, go Nats, World Series last night. He was booed. He was actually loudly booed, and that's a strange reversal. Granted, this is a very liberal town, but the fact that he spoke about this with this kind of childlike enthusiasm, like it was, and he even said it was like watching a movie, yeah, and talking about the whimpering and stuff that he actually could not possibly know. I just wonder how it does that affect the narrative at all, or is that just what we've come to expect from Trump?
My favorite little detail, it's all I've come to respect. My favorite little detail is about the whimpering and the crying, is that Defense Secretary Esper was on TV yesterday morning saying, I don't have that information. The president was probably speaking to commanders on the ground.
Look.
Who provided him with that little detail, some narrative.
I thought
flair.
He blew himself up with a suicide vest. How would he hear a whimper, right?
Well,
doesn't make sense.
So as a psyop, if one can say, there's been a general sense for 25 years that the way you're supposed to talk about terrorists and their death is to talk about how they're cowards. Mm-hmm. They were cowards and mm-hmm. they did cowardly mm-hmm. things, and it's they were cowards and it's terrible. And so portraying al-Baghdadi as dying a coward's death, crying, is in theory a kind of psyop to try to make it clear to people that they shouldn't respect al-Baghdadi. Like a lot of these things, it seems to me that this comes from some weird, I was going to use a negative term that partially involves defecation, but that it's this kind, one of these like theories that you can actually locate maybe in pop culture. Like there's a scene at there's a movie called Angels with Dirty Faces in which James Cagney plays a gangster, and these kids in the neighborhood worship him, and his old friend, who has become the priest, says to him, in order that you don't have these kids follow you into a life of crime, will you go to the gallows, or will you whimper and cry and sound like you're yellow and that you're a coward? And he agrees to do this, and so he, as he's being led to his death, cries, and it's being broadcast on the radio, and all the boys are like,
he's yella. He's a cow, you know. He's yella. They lose all respect for him and therefore might therefore have a chance to live a more upstanding life because they realize that being a criminal isn't brave. And I have always wondered whether these people, when you find out about them, you know, the terrorism experts who turn out to like have a, you know, have a junior degree from a junior college or something like that, but got a contract for $10 squillion from the Defense Department to invent, you know, how to handle suspects that you're going to do, you know, deep interrogations of, whether somebody came up with this idea that you're supposed to say that terrorists are cowards from Angels with Dirty Faces. I mean, because it's so exact. And there's no disproving it, right? So, because they always kept saying it. It's like, he was a coward. This is a cowardly thing to do.
I mean, you don't have to augment the details with this image of him whimpering and pleading for his own life. The guy, based on what we know from officials, not just the president, he took his own life and surrounded himself with children to do it. I mean, that's pretty much the definition of a cowardly.
I have to say, I didn't mind that part of it at all. I'm on board with sort of, you know, posthumously humiliating terrorists who kill. But I was watching his performance, Christine, and sort of ready to cringe at any moment because I feared he was going to misstate something, or as he at one point he actually mispronounced al-Baghdadi's name. I think he called him al-Baghdadi. And at one point he said that we lost a dog. They call them canines. I call them dogs. You know, just the sort of bizarreness of things like that, you know, but which I have come to expect. But I didn't actually find the sort of rubbing salt in the wound part offensive or worrisome at all.
I mean, the troubling aspect of that whole performance was that he's playing this up for politics, and he is due a victory lap. He deserves a victory lap, and the people who are trying to deny him a victory lap are wrong to do so and blinkered partisans in the process. However, that victory lap is going to come to bite him in the butt when we all realize that the terrorist threat is not neutralized, and that will come as a result of an event. It always does. And the president may be committing himself to a narrative which is flawed.
What Trump has disproved, love him or hate him, what he has disproved is the notion that the presidency requires dignity, or that the president benefit. Now we don't know whether he's wrong about this, but that the president needs to behave in a dignified fashion, or that it benefits the president to behave in a dignified fashion, because that is what people expect of the president. It elevates him. It elevates the office. It enhances his power as a public official when he is dealing with other public officials and all of that. Trump refuses to go. Trump is the antithesis of this idea. So he has a moment where, you know, he has ordered U.S. forces to take a very risky move to go, and it's an unqualified success. And then he jumps up and down and does a victory dance and gives himself high fives and all of that. And we look at it and we say, well, that's really, you know what, I don't know. That's not right and all that. But, you know, maybe he's right and we're wrong, because maybe what he knows is that if you're not going to give yourself a victory lap, other people are going to deny it to you. And if you don't make it clear that it's important to you and that you're going to be mad at people, you know, on your own side who don't support your victory lap, then you don't get the victory lap.
Well,
I don't know.
That's the next most important part of this, is obviously this is the president's first good news cycle, and I don't remember how long. And there's a lot of Republicans who've been on his case about the cascading revelations involving Ukraine and now the Syria pullout. So this gives them a little breathing room to just not necessarily go at the president or remain silent. They can say something positive about the president. They've been dying for that opportunity. Does he get a legitimate bounce out of this thing? I don't think he does.
Well, even if he does, it's by definition evanescent, because that's the nature of an event where you kill one person.
Right.
I mean, you know, did Obama benefit from the killing of bin Laden? Yeah, but what were the long term? Would he have gotten one more or fewer vote if bin Laden hadn't been dead? It's a little hard to know. I know they thought that it was the way they were going to sell their foreign policy, But imagine that bin Laden hadn't been gotten, but he had still remained invisible, right? Or, you know, hiding or whatever.
Christine's point is super valid. It's that the president has already been saying the threat is neutralized from ISIS. So now it's more neutralized, the most neutralized.
But again, you're looking for a kind of consistency in logic and argument that we thought was necessary for the practical application of American politics, and that is what he has disproved. Is that, yeah, you can say something is neutralized and then kill al-Baghdadi and say, I just killed al-Baghdadi. So then people say, well, you said it was neutralized. Well, when did I say it? Well, it doesn't matter. I said something now and I said something then. And that's the way it is. And the people who don't like him won't like it. And the people who like him are fine with it. And nothing changes.
That's why he doesn't get any bounce out of this.
Right. But okay. So all bounces in a time of hyperpartisanship involve the following, right? You have people on one side who are making up around 42% of the, you know, people who are polled and therefore potentially the electorate who like him no matter what now. Well, they sort of hardened to about 40 to 42%. And then you have people around 45 to 50% who don't like him, whatever he does, and maybe even a little more, so they say. So if you add that up, that's about 90%. So in theory, there's 10% in the middle who are persuadable or who can, you know, whatever, right? So that's what all this is about. Everything from now until election is about either depressing Trump's own turnout or depressing the Democratic turnout or pushing people for, could something like this help somebody who doesn't like him but doesn't like the Democrats? Could that make them feel a little better about him? Of course it could. Will that be 5 million people? Probably not. But you know, could it be a little bit? Yeah. Question is whether you need to build on it. Like, and that's what he has made difficult for himself. Like, if he wants to position himself as the tough guy who does what's necessary for America abroad, including making the hard decisions to pull our troops out when it's thankless, he can't just do one thing. He already learned that in 2017. When he hit Syria once and then, you know, ran multiple victory laps about how incredibly great it was that he hit Syria for using chemical weapons, and Syria's used chemical weapons 6 or 7 times since then, and he hasn't done anything about it. So therefore,
they make a distinction between complex nerve agents and chlorine, which is the same distinction that Barack Obama made.
Right.
Complex nerve agents, right, is a tripwire, and chlorine is just,
right,
casual chemical warfare.
Right, but what I'm saying is that had he done it every time, then he would have built on what he did the first time, right? But he doesn't do it every time, so not that, you know, it's not like he gets a chance to kill a major terrorist leader every day. But in general terms, you know, you're not going to get credit for stunts. Not that I think this justifies being called this, but politically it will seem like a stunt if it is not part of a more, you know, realized foreign policy.
I mean, the key part about the bounce is whether this has any real impact on the president's support in the Senate vis-a-vis impeachment proceedings.
Well, since there isn't a single senator right now that you can point to who is going to vote to convict him, I don't know how...
Definitively, no.
Right.
Indications are the big three, Romney, Collins, and Murkowski, are flaky. Three.
Right. Plus 47 makes 50. So you're now 17 short. So does this make it harder for Romney? Yes. Romney tweeted out congratulations to Trump yesterday, obviously in a kind of state of relief because he doesn't necessarily want to be the tribune of anti-Trump forces among Republicans. Since, as we know, the one thing you'd say about Mitt Romney is that he's, you know, really a bold and courageous person who does all sorts of incredibly bold and courageous things as a politician. That's why it's so funny that he's, you know, so all the liberals are now pushing him, Mark Leibovich and the New York Times and everything, on how, what a great moment this is for him. Well, if it were such a great moment for him, you know, he wouldn't be so pained about figuring out how many times to say Trump in a sentence or something like that, you know, if he really wanted to be this force. I'm just saying that the idea that this isn't helpful to him with the Senate, it's perfectly helpful, and he doesn't really necessarily need much help. Not not when the Democrats are doing things, and we haven't really talked that much about this. I mean, we've said before that there's no reason Democrats can have these private hearings and the Republicans had them and all of that. But clearly, the argument that Democrats are conducting the impeachment inquiry in a way that seems like they are writing the rules to benefit themselves and not being fair has some populist power behind it. Noah's making a weird face at me, like he doesn't believe that the fact that the entire Republican Party has adopted the idea that
the Republican Party in the House has decided that the House leadership cannot govern the House like leadership governs the House. That's their narrative, and they're sticking to it. Right. Good for them.
It's a ridiculous narrative. Whoever has power gets to control the process.
It's a ridiculous narrative. You know, by the way, you can call it a ridiculous narrative and not say that it doesn't have political bite. So fine. So other houses have done it this way, and this one is getting, you know, crap for doing it another way. So
but
what?
But it's a short-term thinking, because long-term it's a terrible strategy, because as soon as they issue reports and they move forward and things move ahead, that collapses as an argument for the Republicans, I think. It's just
What possible argument would you suggest they take?
They're beginning to make it. They're moving on from process arguments and beginning to adopt the Randian view of view of how we should approach this, which is to argue that quid pro quo is a necessity, that you have to have strings attached to foreign aid, and implicitly therein that it doesn't matter whether they're based in national security or the president's personal political interests. You just have to have strings attached.
Well, that's what Mo Brooks said, right? Mo Brooks said, "Your dad gum better have a quid pro quo if you're going to do something."
Right.
Okay.
Because the process arguments weren't working.
Okay, so they were working. They work to the extent that you don't make a worse argument, which is that it's okay for the president to demand political favors from other countries in exchange for, policy that has been set in law. I mean, that's a worse argument than you're not being fair by having these hearings in secret. So you're saying it would be better if they made a worse argument. So I'm going to dispute you on that.
I surrender.
I mean, if you can come up with a third argument that they should be deploying as opposed to these other two. I think, though, that... Yeah, the only way that this is there are only a couple of ways to go on this argument. One of which is to say, it just whatever it is, and you can say it's terrible, and I'm not going to say anything about it. It doesn't rise to the level of impeachment, which is essentially what Republicans are going to say from now through whatever happens.
At least, to be honest, I haven't actually heard anybody say it in those terms.
Okay, when they are compelled to. Like when actually the House votes on articles of impeachment and Republicans speak during what they're going to say is this is inappropriate.
They'd have to concede that it's bad.
No, just say, I'm not even going to say it's bad. But even if I agreed with you in every particular, even if I agreed with you that what Trump did was wrong, it still doesn't rise to the level of impeachment. It still doesn't justify the first removal of a president from office in American history. That he said he was withholding aid from, or that he was suspending aid to Ukraine, which eventually went through. So therefore, no harm, no foul. Any way you slice it, no harm, no foul. Because they didn't precisely get what they wanted, and the aid went through. It's not an argument. It's a stated position, but I think that will be the Republican Party's position. Hmm. Even if I agreed with you, which I don't, I would still say it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment, or removal, which, by the way, is sort of where I am on it. I mean, I think you'd have to be, you know, Bill Clinton committed an actual felony, committed perjury, and was jury nullified by the Senate. And I thought that was the right move too. By the way, I didn't think that Clinton should have been removed from office lying about a sexual peccadillo.
We got to talk about Katie Hill.
Let's talk about Katie Hill. But before we talk about Katie Hill, I got an ad. I got to read an ad. That's what I got to do. because we're cliffhanging you on Katie Hill. Because let's talk a little about NetSuite. Because if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another for sales, another for inventory, and so on. It's just a big inefficient mess, taking up too much time and too many resources, and that hurts the bottom line. Introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles every aspect of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by managing sales, finance, and accounting, and orders and HR instantly right from your desktop or phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits at netsuite.com/commentary. That's netsuite.com/commentary to download your free guide, 7 key strategies to grow your profits, netsuite.com/commentary. So, Katie Hill, Christine.
Okay,
I give you the floor.
I have to start out by saying something really petty, but I'm going to do it. So, for years we've been reading these big think pieces in New York Times Magazine and elsewhere about how, open marriages and not being monogamous is the future, and this is also good for everybody. And I just want to give everybody Exhibit A, the counter argument, which is Katie Hill. Like this is one of those examples where, all of the idea that this doesn't make your personal life messy and a wreck for many people is there is obviously some evidence to the contrary. So Katie Hill, the Democrat, first Democrat to be elected to the 25th District in California since what, like 1990, the 90s, right? She has evidently been having relationships outside of her marriage with people who work for her, and this has prompted some ethics investigations, and she just resigned. The reaction has been interesting because if she was a man and doing this, I don't think we'd have any doubt there would be a lot of Me Too crowing about, yes, this is inappropriate. She's taking advantage of her power and position. But what we see instead is a lot of hand-wringing about how she's being slut-shamed, how it's just so unfair, and really this is just not the case. So I think it's an interesting example of if you want to have high standards of behavior for people in power, they have to apply equally to men and women. But that's still not where a lot of feminists and Me Too folks are when a woman is taken down by the standards that also take down men.
Okay, so what's interesting to me is that she decided to resign yesterday, right? First, images came out that of her topless or something with a bong
brushing the hair.
She said in traditional house style that it wasn't her and it was photoshopped or something like that. Then she acknowledged it was her, and now she said it's her, but she's being abused by her ex-husband, who says she's trying to get out of an abusive relationship. And now she has resigned, and she's heartbroken, and she then says, but this isn't over, okay? So
well, she's going to fight revenge porn now. Now she's the revenge porn crusader or something. Yeah.
And she cops to the relationship with the campaign staffer, but not with her current, or up until recently current, Hill staff.
Right, okay. So here are two things. Here's what we know, okay? Republicans have no power over any of this whatsoever. Okay, the House is run by Democrats. She is a first-term Democrat. If she is being run out of office on a rail and being forced to resign, this is Nancy Pelosi's doing. It has nothing to do with the Republican media. It has nothing to do with Republicans in Congress. It has nothing to do with men being unfair, and it's not fair because the first time this House ethics investigation into having an inappropriate relationship with a staffer has been exercised since the House changed rules when Nancy Pelosi became Speaker, that now it is going to be a woman who was going to be investigated. Okay, so this is all Democratic Party
damage control. Something happened to Joe Barton, right?
Did it?
Yeah, Joe Barton had that graphic image that was released online in 2017, and then he retired shortly thereafter.
Right. Okay, so my central point here is that this is democratic damage control. Okay, so how this becomes a realm for thumb-sucking think pieces about how Me Too is being applied unevenly when the Speaker of the House, who runs the Democratic Party in the House, is a woman, is very unclear to me. Mm-hmm. And how this will last another 24 hours is something else.
So this came out right after the Daily Mail, which augmented the red state, had the initial image. And then the Daily Mail.
The person of former commentary staffer Alana Goodman,
who got a hold of
Alana Goodman, former commentary staffer.
Is she with Daily Mail now?
Yeah.
Oh,
she's an examiner now.
Yeah, she wrote it.
She had one of the early stories about Katie Hill. Sorry.
Anyway, Alana's very good. So Daily Mail had this, and then I was like, okay, obviously this is the end of her career, her political career, not because she couldn't survive this thing. We have two Republicans who were indicted by grand juries who are currently serving in Congress. It's because her district is dead even PVI.
PVI is the
Cook Political Report Partisan Voting Index, indicating the lean of a particular district in one direction or another. Her district doesn't lean any way. She represents a district in Orange County where Republicans were wiped out in 2018. For the first time in a long time, it's like the historic homeland of the Republican Party, where they were just destroyed on the national level. And there's every indication that they should come back. It's not as though that this is a permanent shift in opinion in Orange County. It was a very good cycle for Democrats, and if Democrats have a less good cycle, there's no reason why Republicans can't come back. And Katie Hill's district is a prime pickup opportunity. And if she were to defend her activity on the campaign stump, she wouldn't have survived. Simple as that.
Right. By the way, she won. Not to get put too fine a point on this, she won the district by being a woman. That is, she ran as a.
Right.
I must be one of the people to make the change in the Me Too era. What's interesting about her is she's very young, right? She's 32, I think.
Yeah. Hmm.
And maybe all of this, not to go Trumpian, was like a little bit of a TV show to her. Like she sort of gets in this race out of nowhere. She laps the establishment candidate. She wins. She's got all these showbiz people backing her. She's in a marriage she doesn't like, or her husband's abused, whatever is the story between her and her husband. And it's all very heady and crazy and fun. She's like a classic young person, Democrat, and so she's like screwing around on the campaign.
The party wanted to make a big deal of her. The party thought she was going to be a very important face of the party, a counter to the AOCs and Ilhan Omar's, because she was a little bit more centrist.
And because she won in a...
Had the right biography.
She won in a...
Won in a swing district.
In a swing district. So, and the point is that she's clearly not... She thought that she didn't have to be cautious and prudent in her private behavior.
Okay, but I got to be a lot tougher than you guys are being on her, because she's now turning herself into a professional victim who claims that the whole reason, she says in her resignation letter, she's going to, all these women and girls who are going to be prevented from running for office because of the exploitation of revenge porn. It's absolutely ridiculous that she is trying to get on a soapbox because her own personal choices, which were not very smart and were quite an abuse of her power, because she was doing this with people who she had the power to pay and hire and fire. The idea that now she's some sort of victim and martyr and revenge porn, Joan of Arc, just really annoys me.
you kind of have to wonder at this point how the left and the media are kind of feeling about their investment in this freshman class, the celebrated freshman class of women, and the arc that they're sort of the most celebrated members, the arc of their term so far has taken. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's not the only one to run into trouble and then make a sort of victim story out of it.
That is a really good angle, and I want 800 words on that.
Well, okay, no, you'll but so it. There are a whole bunch of other women in that class, Katie Spannenberger and I'm trying to remember now
Katie
the
Porter.
Names. Yeah, Katie Porter, the military, Alyssa Slotkin. There are plenty of people who aren't either you know, basically, you know, selling out the country to Cuba, or like having thruples with their staffers. So, you know,
but it's as silly to condemn them as a whole, therefore, right, as it is to elevate them.
To praise them, exactly right.
Right, and to read sort of like the professional sort of feminist commentariat, simply, it's like they're rallying to her side because they all share two X chromosomes. You know, like,
but she victimized someone with two X chromosomes. I mean, this is right? I mean,
the whole thing is, well, I mean, it's not like these relationships were non-consensual. I thought the whole point was that you couldn't have a real relationship with consent if somebody was a superior and other people work for them. And indeed, this, you know, ex male staffer, she gave some huge bonus to.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's the one she denies. She denies that there's a relationship there with the male staffer, right? Uh-huh.
Does she?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It's the female.
But what's the thruple then? What's the who did she have the thruple with?
The female.
That was the Hill staffer.
But a thruple is three people.
Yeah,
Hill staffer, campaign staffer.
See, messy. It gets really messy.
Right. Then we haven't even talked about Ilhan Omar and her 38-year-old boyfriend who's married to the 55-year-old woman to whom she gave a $250,000 whose organization she paid $250,000 to last year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just saying, like, you know, when you elevate people. When you make a big PR deal out of people, there's a reason why you want to, like, keep your powder dry for a year or two until you find out that they're really worth the celebrating. You know, that's part of prudence. You know, it's like why there are farm teams, and, you know, why you don't bring a pitcher up to the major leagues until he shows that he can pitch in the minors, or why, you know, actors don't immediately get to, you know, sort of center $250 million movies without some experience. And the same thing is true in politics. When when people become sort of phenoms of the moment, they often, it turns out, are like that. I mean, I don't think it's really quite right in Katie Hill's case, more like in the Swads case, where it's like you raise them and they go all nutso because they've never had this kind of attention. And then it turns out that, you know, maybe they would have been better off being under the radar and cleaning up some of their messes before they become major stars. But that's no longer in anybody's power to control. It used to be sort of in the power of the parties to control, because you kept them quiet. You kept them on minor committees. You didn't let them speak, you know, in major debates. And things like that until they were ready, and so that's no longer an option, apparently.
But it also doesn't suggest, I mean, if you're a Me Too supporter who thinks this movement has largely been for the good, it should give one pause and think about some of the tropes that the movement is operating on, even if it's not, you know, deliberately. This idea that women can pivot to becoming victims whenever their own behavior has gotten them into trouble is problematic, but it actually does fit with the more extreme views of the Me Too movement, right? I mean, she's still playing the victim, even though she was the victimizer. And I think that what we should see is more caution, because, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. I mean, she's died by the sword, but she's still the victim. And I mean, even Al Franken, it took, you know, a year to attempt to rehabilitate him as a victim, and that still hasn't succeeded.
But again, she could have stayed. No one is making her resign. This has to be very clear. Like, she is under no obligation to resign. They haven't even started an ethics investigation of her. And even if they do an ethics investigation or that finds that there was wrongdoing, she doesn't have to resign.
Must be more she knows is going to get uncovered. Or
Nancy Pelosi went to her and said, you are going to be the spearhead of the Democrats losing the House. Is that what you want? You want to be the face of the loss of the Democratic House in 2020? Yeah. You want the evil Republicans to be in charge come January 2021? Well, that's what's going to happen. And she's young enough and stupid enough to believe it, perhaps. Because, of course, that really wouldn't happen. But she also didn't expect any of this to happen either. And by the way, how do we know that her husband was abusive? She says her husband was abusive. That's what she said. I know, yeah. But we don't know her husband was abusive. So she's getting divorced from somebody. And, you know, she was there. I mean, this is the whole point of all these things when they talk about revenge porn. I understand the theory of the horrors of revenge porn and everything. But she's not a 15-year-old, you know, who makes a horrible decision to take a picture of herself and send it to somebody, right? The horrible, you know, somebody who doesn't have a totally developed, sense of consequences in her brain and all of that, and does this terrible thing and then has this follow her. She's in her 30s and a congressional candidate, and she's taking pictures. She's allowing pictures of herself to be taken naked with her hair being brushed, or brushing somebody's hair, or whatever the hell else is happening. Like, I understand that it's kind of gross that it got out in public, but she doesn't get the pass that a high school kid gets for making a really, really horrible, wrong-headed decision, because she's, you know, like, in the House of Representatives.
Yeah, naked bong rips. I mean, there's no surviving that.
Yeah.
There's a universally applicable standard of behavior that says congresswoman doing naked bong rips on camera is not the best.
Yeah,
thing
no, she should, be on, she should live in the house in the real world on the next episode of The Real World, right?
Well, she's taking the hit for the first time. The next time it happens, people, it'll
that's
be
right.
Okay.
Yeah, Doug Ginsburg couldn't
she
be
made
on
the
Supreme
of
Court
stepping down.
Here's how Doug Ginsburg couldn't be on the Supreme Court, because he tried marijuana once, and then, you know, Barack Obama could like blow cocaine every 5 seconds, you know, 20 years later, and that was fine. So Doug Ginsburg had to quit the minute that someone found out that he, you know, that he, and Bill Clinton had to say that he didn't inhale. And now it's okay. Now everybody can smoke pot, right? So I guess everyone can be in a thruple with a, you know, with a naked selfie. In fact, it's expected. What kind of a weird Puritan were you in high school that you, you don't have a naked selfie in your past? I mean, is that that I think, you know, is one dystopian vision of our, you know, of our coming future? No. And anyway, and with that, we will, I think this is a relatively brief episode we will bring to a close. So for Noah, Abe, and Christine, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.